This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. The following program was homecrafted and recorded on May 2nd. Saturday, voters in the city of Austin decided the fate of 8 propositions in a special election. The Austin Chronicle noted that 7 of them, all but Prop B, were proposed amendments to the city charter, which can only be done at 2-year intervals. 7, all but Prop C, were also citizen initiatives whose backers gathered signatures to place them on the ballot. Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. Our guest this evening is Mike Clark Madison, news editor and columnist for the Austin Chronicle, researcher, analyst, consultant, strategist, and organizer. Mike has shaped civic dialogue in Texas for more than 30 years. How are you doing today, Mike?
I'm doing okay, Bob. How you doing?
Oh, I'm a little flustered. Hey, thanks for filling in for Austin Sanders last week. I think he's going to join us again next week. We had an election yesterday.
Yeah, we did. We started to talk about this a little bit last week. Obviously, the big news that everyone was paying attention to was the camping ban, Proposition B, which did pass by a pretty sizable margin, about 14 points, 57 to 43. I don't think that that was a huge surprise to a lot of people. I think maybe the scope of how much it won by was, and I'm not even sure that was that big of a surprise to people. Well, first of all, they spent $1 million on this. I mean, I keep mentioning that as I write about it because I don't want people to like forget that. That's still a lot of money for a citywide, election in Austin. And it might have won if they had not spent as much money to turn people out, which, they did a very good job of identifying people who probably would not have come out to vote in a May election that turned out to vote for the proposition. The old saw in politics is if you're explaining, you're losing. Mm-hmm. And for about a year now, at least, the city has been explaining what it's trying to do with policies regarding homelessness. What people are seeing is not responding to what the city is trying to do. There are no signs of progress being made. And it's thus pretty easy when you are on the side of Save Austin Now, which is, while it claims bipartisanship, and yes, and obviously they got more than just Republicans voting for them if they were able to win the election yesterday. The actual campaign was very much a Republican piece of work.
Given that Matt Mikoyak was the...
Right, yeah. I mean, that it was being run by the chair of the Travis County Republican Party. They had the endorsement of the governor. Clearly, we knew which side this was on. And, they had a fairly simple case to make. Do you believe what Steve Adler is telling you, or do you believe your eyes? Given all that, I don't think that it's that much of a surprise that it passed. I don't think that it means that Austin is a different place than we thought it was before.
This was one of the propositions that appeared on there through the petition process. How many signatures does someone need to get one of these on the ballot?
It's about 20,000. It's a percentage of the registered voters in the city. Mm-hmm. And at this point, the round number is about 20,000. It goes up or down. The first time Save Austin Now tried to get this on the ballot was for the November election. They turned in a bunch of signatures, and the city clerk, what the office does is sample them. You know, they don't go through all 20,000, 25,000, 30,000 that they submit to see if they're all signatures of Austin registered voters. They pick a sample and they predict how many of them are going to be legit based on that. The first time she said, nope, you didn't make it. Mm. And there was a bunch of like huffing and puffing, and they filed a lawsuit about it and everything. But then they just kept going and collecting more signatures. And the second time they made it, clearly, this effort required them to go out and get all these signatures, which is not as hard as, I mean, I think people have gotten that down to a science now in Austin, just because it's been a factor of local elections for so long that people just kind of know what it takes to run a signature operation, how much money it costs, how many people you have to hire to gather signatures, when you have to go out and do it. It's pretty much established now. So it's not that hard, but they were, you know, in the more difficult circumstances of having to do that during COVID. Originally, one of the ways in which they were trying so that they could make the August deadline for the November election is they mailed the petition to every Austin registered voter. That's really expensive. And, you know, there's a reason that other campaigns don't do it. I mean, I guess they got some signatures out of that, but this all lasted for like more than a year of them campaigning on this pushback against the council vote in June of 2019 to roll back the ordinances that had been in place for 20 years about public camping and sitting and lying on the sidewalk and otherwise, you know, criminalizing aspects of homelessness. Basically, it is just returning to what the law was before June of 2019. It only applies to downtown and around the UT campus because a lot of the areas that people are seeing encampments now, those are actually not legal places to camp anyway. But those encampments have been largely undisturbed during the pandemic because federal guidelines say that you're not supposed to go in and do sweeps of these because that's simply creating an opportunity to spread COVID. The degree to which it's not even really covering as much as people think it is going to be interesting to see how this all plays out going forward, because I think a lot of people voted for this thinking that there's going to be some significant change in what they see in terms of encampments, in terms of how unsheltered Austinites are living and being treated and allowed to live. That's probably not really going to happen very much. In terms of policy, going back to like June of 2019, when these changes in the law were made, and it was, you know, it was a big victory for progressive activists who wanted to decriminalize homelessness for all of the reasons that one should. But by October, this had already become something that Governor Abbott and Republican activists had decided that they were going to make an issue to score points against the city of Austin, which is a very easy way for Texas Republicans to score points with their base, is by dunking on the city of Austin. Mm-hmm. So that was back in October of 2019. That was before COVID. It was before any of the larger reckoning with policing and depolicing, police violence that we had in the summer of 2020. So rolling back the ordinances in 2019 was kind of a failed experiment that the city has acknowledged that this fairly high profile commitment, making it the number one priority issue of the city council, you know, allocating ultimately about $160 million over 2 years in the budget to deal with it, you know, it's basically flopped. Mm-hmm. And part of that is because of COVID, not just the pandemic changing facts on the ground for the unsheltered poor and encampments and how we manage homelessness, but also overwhelming the people at the city of Austin who were supposed to be doing all of this new ambitious special strategies for homelessness. They kind of got their jobs changed pretty quickly once the pandemic hit. It's all the same people in social services and public health and such. The city hired a homelessness strategy officer back in 2019. She lasted like a month. They put money into programs that they ended up having to take the money back out. Yeah, everything has gone wrong for them, really, in terms of addressing this with the big strategic direction that they wanted to. And so by the time the election actually happened, it was very, very difficult for the council and particularly the mayor to say, hey, we've got this under control, because not only do the facts on the ground suggest that no, you don't, but the actual, you know, story of what has happened over the last close to 2 years suggests that no, the city is kind of flailed at this a little bit.
They did buy 4 hotels.
Right. Which, you know, but they wanted to have bought 4 hotels a year ago.
Yeah.
And it took like a year for the first one to get bought.
Right.
And then they got to the point where, okay, they're moving much more rapidly at buying them now for permanent supportive housing. They're now getting like slapped back on the one in Williamson County that was so controversial, right, with the county commissioners up there saying that they are going to, I guess, file suit against the city to enforce the deed restrictions on that property that say that it's not supposed to be residential, which, you know, is a workaround for them to do what they really want to do, which is to just NIMBY this. So all of this, yeah, like we're going to have a hotel site in every district that, so that there will be housing all over the city for people. Yes, that's a good policy goal, but they did not sell this properly to the people who were out there.
Right.
And so all of that has going along that, you know, people just don't know like what. Well, I thought you were going to buy these hotels. Well, we are, but it's taking more time than we expected. You know, I thought you were going to make an alternate shelter site. Well, that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought you were going to look at doing designated campsites. Well, right, we weren't going to do that because that was, you know, not best practice, but now we are going to. This sort of back and forth, I'm not saying that the city should be feel bad about having done this poorly, but it doesn't bode well for them trying to defend themselves in the context of an election. Right. And so it was much easier for the other side to say, look, they don't know what they're doing. But it's unclear now at this point, you know, so yes, you know, Save Austin Now won, the governor won, Matt Mikoyak won, but what did they win? Because the policies are probably not going to change that much, because what's become clearer, I think, to people over the last 2 years, part of this trial and error of city policy is that there really aren't any shortcuts to creating permanent supportive housing and rapid rehousing for people, and nothing else will do. There is no like intermediate step of, you know, being able to shelter people or being able to get them into services without housing or what have you. What the city has to do is bite the bullet and communicate to the people of Austin, who I think ultimately will accept it, that, yeah, this is going to cost like $100 million a year that we're going to have to spend on housing people who need services, who will always need services, and that's just part of what it means to be in a civil society, because the alternative is having them live on the street. I think that it would be nice if we were in that place now. Last night, you know, Greg Kassar, who I guess of any of the council members you could say was the one who was like the most rebuked by the passage of Proposition B, was saying, you know, we all agree that what we need to do is create housing for people. We need like 3,000 homes. And that's absolutely true. And I'm not sure what passing Prop B didn't actually get us closer to doing that. So it remains to be seen how it changes the conversation, what people's expectations are going to be going forward. Like, how quickly are they expecting to see encampments disappear? or what do they think is going to happen to unsheltered Austinites if they see them camping or sitting and lying in the sidewalk? Are they going to simply be thrown in jail or what? I think a lot of that still remains to be determined.
The city's buying these hotels, and Community First is 1,400 units mm-hmm. of housing they've announced. And the typical reaction was, well, we had to do something.
Yeah.
You know? And yeah. Prop B just smacks of that in my own mind. But
Sure. I've also heard it described as a vote in no confidence.
Yeah.
In city government, not for any like particular, again, you know, it's not changing any particular policy.
Right.
But, you know, it's just saying, well, we don't agree with the direction that you're taking, and certainly degree to which, for whatever purposes it serves them, Travis County GOP, Greg Abbott, whatever, or, you know, dunking on Austin and saying that they won this big victory is going to help them in some way. I'm thinking it's kind of a sugar high.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, they're going to wake up and still the Travis County Republican Party doesn't have a single office holder in exactly. Travis County. I mean, except maybe Mackenzie Kelly, city council member, because half of her district is in Williamson County.
Right.
There are more Democrats in Williamson County government than there are Republicans in Travis County government. So it's not like this is like a big groundswell of political realignment going on here.
Right.
But I do think that, yeah, people felt like they had to do something. What was happening wasn't working. They didn't know how to resolve the way that they felt about it because it made a lot of people uncomfortable for a lot of reasons, not all of which are bad. And it became inevitable, but it also didn't really solve anything in terms of what are we actually going to do about this crisis.
And ultimately, it is the homeless who are going to be punished in this.
It is, yes. And I don't want to minimize that. It's not like this doesn't matter. You know, it clearly is going to make life more difficult for people whose lives are really already very difficult. And to, you know, no particular end. So, no, it was not a good thing
right.
or a meaningless thing that it happened. It's still something that we should be looking to try to counter in some way going forward. But the way to do that is to help people actually find places to live
yes.
in Austin.
Proposition F, the strong mayor. That one was pretty resounding.
That was bad. Yeah, that was about the worst. I haven't done all of my historical research on this yet, but I'm pretty sure this was the worst loss
yeah.
suffered by any citizen initiative in like memory.
The opposition that I picked up from Emily Tim there and others was basically, you know, this is going to put too much power in one person and it'll be subject to manipulation in a way that we've not seen before.
Sure. And I think that the ATX for All group that ran against this with a lot of support from the Central Labor Council was one campaign running against Prop F. And then there was the other campaign that was Austin for All People, which was more of the business community and the conventional centrist leaders. So they were coming at it from both directions. By the end of the campaign, you know, Austinites for Progressive Reform, again, the group that was formed to put this and the other charter amendments around it on the ballot, you know, they also came in with a fair amount of money, not as much as Save Austin Now, but enough to run a citywide petition drive and get these things on the ballot before anyone really even knew what was happening. And so a lot of people kind of, because they got their petitions on during the, you know, kind of run up to the election and right after a lot of the peak of the conflicts regarding the Austin Police Department. So the issue that the council could not fire the police chief, only the city manager could fire the police chief, and he wasn't going to, was top of mind for a lot of, you know, progressives who otherwise would not have really given this sort of thing the time of day. But anyway, it did get on the ballot, and then everyone realized, oh, heck, this is a really big deal. And this is happening really fast. And Austin doesn't like to make changes like this really fast. You know, we tend to deliberate on these things for years and years. So it became pretty clear that nobody was going to back up APR when the going got tough.
Yeah.
And so by the end, you know, they, like I said, they started with a lot of money. By the end of the campaign, you know, the campaign filings from both the labor group and the business group were showing that they were, you know, outraising and outspending them significantly. And they just totally kind of owned the ground game and at the end. And so it's not surprising that it lost. It is surprising that it lost that badly.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of hard to imagine. Like I said, you know, it takes 20,000 signatures to get on the ballot. It right. barely got 20,000 votes.
Right. So. Wow. So people who signed the petition may have voted against it, huh?
But it could happen. Well, and there were some fairly high profile defections from APR over their process. People who originally were on their steering committee, you know, who then said, well, wait, no, I didn't actually agree to this. Yeah. But that's as may be. And I do think that probably having people who came out to vote for Prop B generally were not a particularly pro Prop F audience. So that didn't help them very much.
Well, what resonates with me is the veto power that this adds, you know, this,
sure.
this really ups the ante, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, people are used to how, you know, council, we've had 10-1 now for, you know, 8 years and people are just, you know, kind of getting used to how this works in terms of what sort of accountability and representation and how clearly citizens and their goals are expressed on council and how they would become ordinances and how this, you know, the council moves. We pretty much have just kind of settled into how that all works. Mm-hmm. And then for this plan to come forward and say, oh, and now we're going to change all of that. And we're going to like create this strong mayor that Austin has never had or hasn't had since 1910. And yeah, it'll be like in New York or Chicago, which are not necessarily good things that in the minds of many Austin voters. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that this person would have, they would have veto power. They would, you know, it would create this completely different dynamic of city government. I mean, the initial resistance to Prop F, which was largely coming from progressives and labor, was specifically rooted in that. It was people who had seen the gains that they had made under 10-1 that finally, we had a council that had a diversity of representation from all sides of town, from all communities, and thus the actual political spectrum of Austin, meaning that there was a more empowered voice for the Austin left than there had been for all of the years in which the councils were elected at large. And that that translated into progressive policies, not all of which were controversial. So to see that and say, now what Austin needs is a mayor who can undo all of that, who can kind of bring this back to where we were for all of those years, where ultimately the center of Austin politics was somebody who had 1 foot west of Mopac and 1 foot in central Austin and could speak to all of the various issues of mostly white homeowners and not particularly represent the East Side or the growing number of people in Austin who are neither white nor homeowners. And that, you know, going back to that seemed not just a bad idea, but a really threatening one. And people got mobilized really quickly to stop it. And much more quickly than they did to stop Prop B, which I think is part of the reason, another factor in those results. So yeah, I think whatever legs this idea had last year when it was first created, you know, they've pretty well dissipated. The rest of the APR amendments, two of them passed.
Right.
the two that were kind of like the least significant passed.
But the companion one here, Prop G, it was never stated, but really wasn't it an outgrowth of F?
Yeah, I mean, originally it was proposed by APR that if the mayor became separate from the council, the mayor was no longer a member of the council, that they would add an 11th council district so that it would still be 11 people. The city council, when they were putting the ballot together, said, no, we should take that out and make it separate. And then people got all kind of confused because if both of them had passed or both of them had failed, otherwise you would have an even number of council members.
Right.
You would have deadlocks.
Right.
Which we said in our endorsement in the Chronicle, that's not as big a deal as people thought. It was sort of another sense of like, well, what problem are we trying to solve here? And after all of these years of carefully crafting, in recent memory, this is only 10 years ago that we passed the 10-1 district system. And as you know, that took like 30 years for Austin to finally line up behind a single member district plan that it supported. And it took us holding the election in November, when we would have all of the presidential turnout, for it to finally get passed. And the plan that was passed in 2012 is very carefully crafted to have this independent redistricting commission that is going to depoliticize the entire process so that you can trust it, maybe to a degree that in future years we're going to think is probably overkill, but was certainly essential to get it passed the first time. Here, only just a couple of years later, now we're saying, oh yeah, we can just add another district whenever we feel like it. The initial reaction of Austin voters when stuff like this happens is always going to be no. I think had Prop G, so the 11th district, and then Prop H, the Democracy Dollars public financing plan, those only lost by about like 13, 14 points, about the same that Prop B won by. And if that had been the result, then sure, we probably could have predicted that sometime in the next couple of years, we would have a charter review commission come forward, because you can only amend the charter every 2 years. So we've amended the charter with this election, so it won't be for another 2 years. But that in 2 years, we would have a charter review commission that would actually consider whether or not we should go to a strong mayor. But now it'll be decades before anybody is going to say, oh yeah, let's go back to consider that idea that lost by, 8-1.
We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. This evening's show was homecrafted and recorded on May 2nd. Our guest this evening is Mike Clark Madison, news editor for the Austin Chronicle. We're discussing the results of the special election that was held this past Saturday. Let's pick up where we left off. You mentioned ranked choice. E was ranked choice.
So the two APR amendments that passed were D and E. So D moves the mayoral election to the presidential election cycle. Mm-hmm. We said this was like, there was no real reason not to do this.
Right.
There was a reason, though, that when all of this was crafted again, back when 10-1 was very carefully crafted, that they put the mayoral election in the gubernatorial cycle because they thought that that would increase turnout in a lower turnout midterm. But I think the argument that the one person who is elected citywide should be elected by the widest possible electorate is a pretty hard one to counter. So that passed. So that's going to happen. Whoever gets elected mayor in 2022 will serve for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And then in 2024, we'll elect again for 4 years. And that will be the cycle going forward. So that happened.
Right.
And then Prop E is ranked choice voting, which as we probably talked about a little bit earlier, we're not sure that ranked choice voting is legal or not in Texas right now, because the Texas election code doesn't say anything about it. It does say that in the event that nobody reaches 50% in an election, that there should be a runoff. It doesn't necessarily say that that runoff should be another head-to-head with the top two finishers in 6 weeks later, like that we've done.
It's sort of a built-in runoff, you know?
Yeah, and the point of doing ranked choice is instant runoff, so that rather than having to have a second election with, you know, a fraction of the turnout that the first round did, that nobody wants to have. It's like in December. I mean, you know, people are totally ready to not pay attention to politics anymore. And we're asking them to come back and like, oh yeah, vote for your council member. So having the instant runoff would be a good thing, no matter what the mechanism for doing it was. And ranked choice voting is a fairly simple to understand. It's just what it sounds like. You rank your top five candidates. And the people who, you know, the fifth place choices get reallocated to the fourth place, third place, and so on all the way up until there are only two people. It's what New York City is doing for this mayoral primary that's coming up in June, which is a really high profile test case for how it works. It's used it on some of the city council special elections that it's had so far, and it has not changed the outcomes in any way that would make you not want to do it because somehow it would affect the outcome of the vote in a way that you kind of want to try to avoid when you're doing these kind of changes to electoral systems. That if they had done conventional runoffs in these races, the same two people would have finished it at the top. So given that, it's a pretty, you know, it's a method that does not itself create predictable changes in the outcome.
Yeah.
But it saves you all of the time and expense and energy of having this second runoff. And it literally allows everyone to participate in the second round of the election. So there's a lot of stuff going for it. And there's not necessarily a reason why it would not be amenable to at least some of the, I mean, it's hard to say now because looking at the Texas legislature's, you know, as it's addressing voter rights, it's just like complete circus, complete clown car right now. But maybe at some point when cooler heads have prevailed, they will look at this and say, yeah, you know, that's not actually a bad idea. And it's not really going to hurt anything or, you know, create an advantage for that we don't want to create for Democratic voters. So let's go for it. And so by 2022, it might in fact be in place.
You know, I don't remember the exact figure, but I do recall Dana DeBeauvoir citing a figure, and I think it was in the hundreds of thousands of dollars just to run an election here.
Yeah, it's about 650,000, I think.
Yeah, that's what I thought, around a half a million.
Even if it's just like a couple of districts, because we have early voting that has to happen at vote centers that still happen all over town. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's a lot of money. And the turnout drop wrote up in the endorsements that, you know, those with long memories, remember back when, you know, council elections were in May.
Right.
And, you know, they had poor turnout generally. I mean, like the 22% that we had turnout yesterday, that's the highest turnout in a May election in Austin since 1994. But it was bad turnout, but it wasn't necessarily worse turnout for the runoff, because it was just kind of like the election kept going and people were more focused and, you know, campaigns got, you know, came up to a fever pitch and all that kind of stuff. This time it's like, you know, the drop off between in 2020, between the November and December turnout, even just within the districts where there was a runoff, was like 70%. So it's kind of hard to say that what we're doing now is creating some sort of beneficial democratic outcome that something else would not surpass.
Right.
So I think just in terms of, you know, generally, if your goal is to have more people have more participation that matters in elections, then sure, Prop E is a good idea. Yeah. So that passed. So we'll see if that happens. And that, you know, That was a charter amendment. So it will be 2 years before we have another one. And then the other two items on the ballot that had nothing to do with either Prop B or APR.
Right.
Were also both charter amendments, and they both passed handily. And one was Prop A was the Austin firefighters, who got resounding support for amending the charter to allow them to basically force contract talks to arbitration when they're at an impasse, which they didn't have up until now. It required both them and the city to agree to go to arbitration, which the city never wants to do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is good news for the firefighters, and they've been fighting for this for a long time. They have done it the right way. I mean, they got collective bargaining back in 2004, and again, by going to the voters. So they've, you know, placed their faith in the voters of Austin to support their labor rights, which is very different from the Austin Police Association, and they were rewarded. And then the Proposition C, which was the only one that is not a citizen initiative, this was actually put on the ballot by council, was to move the Office of Police Oversight from where it is now, where it reports to the city manager, to report to the city council. So it's like the city auditor now, which, you know, originally we had the police monitor.
Right.
And that was a creation of the contract, the meet and confer contract between the city and the police union. It operated under terms that both of them had to agree to, which is kind of, you know, not particularly promising if you want to have authentic independent police oversight. So when the council rejected the contract in 2017, 2018, I can't remember, but they rejected the APA contract, and then they worked without a contract for a year. During that year, Spencer Kronk, the city manager, said, well, I'm going to hire the police monitor, Farrah Muscadin, as my employee to run this Office of Police Oversight. And that's what she's been doing ever since, which has been a marked improvement.
Mm-hmm.
But she reports to Spencer Kronk, and the police chief reports to Spencer Kronk.
Right.
And so that's kind of creates a conflict of interest for him. And so the idea was, well, let's give council the decision to either whether they want to actually hire and fire the director of the office themselves, or whether they want to organize it in some other way. There is a lot of energy within the justice advocate community to have the office be basically citizen run, that the council would enable it, and it would, you know, hire Farrah or Farrah's successors. And everyone likes Farrah, so I don't think she is the issue here. Mm-hmm. But that it could create a citizen run process board, something that where it wouldn't have, people could feel that neither the city manager nor the council nor the police were getting in the way of independent accountability for the Austin Police Department.
Yeah.
And so that opportunity now exists. And that's, you know, that was a pretty kind of under the radar thing, but that was a pretty solid progressive victory from yesterday. Again, you know, some of the same people who voted for Prop B probably voted for this. So. Yeah.
Well, and I wonder too, how much of this was motivated by the council's relationship with Brian Manley, you know?
Oh, of course. All of it, probably. I mean, you know, obviously Brian Manley is gone, and Joe Chacon, even though he was an assistant chief under Brian Manley as part of the, you know, APD executive team that is more problematic, that a lot of advocates think is problematic kind of in its entirety.
Right.
He's definitely seen as, you know, less of a stumbling block for progressives, for council, for people moving on into, you know, wanting to move on with the depolicing agenda than Brian Manley was, than Troy Gay would have been, who is Brian Manley's chief of staff, who would have been the next in line.
Right.
Who was the acting chief when Brian Manley was, you know, taking his accrued vacation at the end of his tenure. And he's already shown that he is willing to come out publicly to back the positions of the council against the positions of Copland, that he's come out speaking against permitless carry, which a lot of police are. I mean, he's not unique in that, but he also, you know, came to the legislature to testify against the Senate bill that would take away the city's taxing authority if it reduced the police budget, mm-hmm. which is kind of the latest manifestation of what the, you know, pushback against depolicing is going to be at the Capitol. It's still not really clear what's going to happen, if right. anything, of these bills in the Capitol. But Joe Chacon has come out and said, no, you don't need to do this. You know, that he's not, I mean, I don't think he plans on being the permanent police chief. Yeah, I think he's looking at the end of his career too. So he's going to say, I'm going to retire after this while the city finds the police chief they want who is committed to reform and to depolicing. And to that end, like we were talking about last week, what our cover story is this week is, you know, the recommendations of the Reimagining Public Safety Task Force, which while, you know, Greg Abbott and Matt Mikowiak and all of these folks are saying that, you know, crazy Austin has gone off the edge and, you know, can't be trusted, we've got this whole process going on that's like much larger than just how the city deals with unsheltered homelessness as a law enforcement matter. That is, again, still kind of progressing in fairly orderly fashion. You know, so far, like the degree to which it is significant that the entire city council for 2 years now has been backing efforts to reduce the police budget, decouple services from the police department, reallocate funds that are going to policing now to other kinds of services, all of the things that they said they were going to do, is really remarkable. And there are some cracks in that armor, perhaps, that, it's not unanimity now, of course, that's because Mackenzie Kelly is on the council, so there's one vote against it. But it's still not clear that, oh man, none of this could possibly happen. You know, that everything will just snap back to the way it was 2 years ago before, when it was unheard of that they would consider reducing the police budget. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Because I think, again, you know, Prop B does not reflect, I think, any kind of change in the fundamentals of Austin politics. I mean, mm-hmm. it's kind of an engineered result from having, again, $1 million to spend and a long time to prepare a campaign and, you know, the bully pulpit of the governor in your corner, right. and, you know, the clear evidence that what is the status quo is not acceptable to anyone.
Right.
But when you don't have those things in place, you have a lot less support for just kind of going back to the way it always was than I think a lot of, you know, folks on the right, police union, the governor, et cetera, think there is. I mean, I think they genuinely think that nobody actually really believes this stuff and that it's only just these, like, you know, crazy progressive activists who are thinking of the future without police. And I think they're going to be surprised at how much serious consideration some of these things are going to get from the city of Austin going forward.
It'll be interesting to see what kind of a transition plan is offered through all this. You know, my sense of the task force is a pretty clear goal. This is where we want to be. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how long is it going to take to get there, and what are going to be the steps to do that? Not entirely clear to me. I mean, maybe you see things that I don't in there, but.
No. There's still a lot to be decided. It's like how you actually get from here to there,
yeah.
step by step is going to be a question.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, there are folks in the advocate community who are on the task force who think that the city should have done this all already. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that they're not means that they're not really committed to it. And I don't know. I mean, I think there's probably more willingness to move forward than they think also. But yeah, it's not as simple as like, oh yeah, we're just going to do all of this. And what that means is that, you know, in some defined number of years, there's not going to be APD police patrols. I don't know what we have to do in order to get broad community buy-in for the most abolitionist recommendations of the task force. But the fact that we're even having this conversation and that, you know, the broad spectrum of people who matter in Austin politics are having this conversation, that it is a legitimate thing that you can talk about, is just really remarkable.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's that much willingness to bury it. I don't think people want to just put this on the shelf and say, that's nice, and move on to whatever the next. We've satisfied that. We've scratched that itch. I mean, I'm certainly, there's a lot of activists who think that that's what the city is doing, because that's what the city has always done before. I don't blame them for thinking that. But I don't know that it is, in fact, true.
Well, there was clearly a lot of investment in this task force, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It would be a real slap in the face if that were just thrown out, you know, or
sure. And a lot of investment by the city itself. I mean, it wasn't just investment in like, we're going to enable a group of community activists to lay out their vision for depolicing because we think that it's politically palatable for us to do so, but we're not really committed as a city. Like city management is not really committed to thinking about this stuff.
Yeah.
They are. There's like five city staff people, you know, members of the executive team.
Brian Oakes was like right out front in this.
Yeah, he's co-chair. Exactly. I mean, there, if they were going in places where City Hall did not want to go, then they did a really good job of hiding that fact, because everything that came out of this is that this was, you know, to the degree that really is possible given where trust is in, you know, the status quo in relationships between city, community, police. They did pretty much everything they could to make this a real thing.
Right.
And make it something that, you know, council's just not going to be able to say, okay, that's nice, but we have our own ideas.
Right.
So.
Well, and as you pointed out, you know, they've already, I mean, they moved the crime lab, they moved the 911 services. I mean, they've followed through that far, you know?
Right. There's probably other stuff, you know, following that. I mean, there is some question like what's going to happen with victim services. I think there is a realization that the existing APD victim services operation does have stakeholders who value it in the community, including advocates for those who are, you know, survivors of violence, but that there also needs to be an alternative or complementary survivor services support system for people who don't want or feel that their needs are going to be met within the umbrella of the police department. But that's, you know, change that's going to happen.
Right.
And there's the question of how much, you know, there's a fairly specific set of recommendations for transferring resources from public safety to public health.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of making kind of the, you know, frontline point of contact, eyes on the ground, city employee who is monitoring for community wellness, instead of that being a patrol cop, that it can be a promotora, a community health worker who knows all of these folks. Mm-hmm. And that shift, I mean, whether it's a one-for-one shift, there's lots of work to do before that happens. But the fact that we're going to take some resources that we are currently spending on policing, and we're going to spend them on something that isn't policing, that is going to do the same thing, that bridge will have to be crossed at some point. And I think it will be crossed. I don't know to what degree, whether it's going to be kind of a pilot program or whether it's going to be something that they plan and have another task force to kind of come up with implementation, but it's something that they know that they can do. And one of the things that the task force emphasized is that they didn't make any of this stuff up. They weren't just like spitballing these ideas during these task force meetings. These are all things that exist. These are all evidence-based, proven strategies that have, you know, impacts, that communities that get this kind of, you know, frontline engagement from community health workers are healthier, but also more stable and have less incidence of things that right now are leading to police calls and so on. And the same with, you know, the same with 911. When we finally do have our mental health first responder corps stood up in places where it happens, that it makes a real significant difference. So those are the things that I think we'll be looking at going forward, but I don't think the conversation at City Hall is going to be, how do we avoid doing the things that the task force asked us to do? It's going to be, how do we make these things happen without kind of having sort of the same failures of execution that we did with our homelessness strategies?
Right. Well, let's not hold that up as a model, okay?
Exactly, yeah. It's like people are like, well, we tried to reinvent the way we did something and look what happened. But part of it is, and I think the advocates would tell you this, is that, well, it's that you didn't really reinvent it. It's that you just put a lot more energy and investment into a system that was already broken. And so it continued to be broken. But you need to change the actual fundamentals of the system. And I think that includes, I mean, the recommendations of the task force include recommendations for how to deal with the social service needs of Austin's unhoused, unsheltered poor. So we'll see what happens.
Yes, plenty for us to keep our eyes open for here in the next several months.
Yes.
And plenty to write about in the Chronicle and plenty
always
to talk about on this show.
Oh, look, there's always news. News never stops.
Really appreciate your time here today, Michael, and great analysis of what people were voting on yesterday. It'll be interesting to see if there's any sort of demographic analysis that comes out of yesterday's vote.
Sure. I mean, I'm sure people will be looking at it, and we'll be looking at it too, that the basic one is that, like we said, you know, this is the highest turnout for a May election in nearly 20 years.
Yeah.
Nearly 30 years, I should say.
30 years.
So who are these people who voted that would not have voted otherwise?
Right, exactly.
So that's what we want to see, right, I think, going forward, because that's going to be a model, I think, for how people want to use the initiative and the system that is available to them in the city charter. You know, we've kind of gotten, like I said, we've gotten to a point where getting something on the ballot, that's been solved. The problem, the way to do that. Winning those elections is definitely not as easy as getting things on the ballot. But I think people are going to start to see, okay, we've got citizen initiative. We can use it for certain things. How are we going to actually be able to use it effectively?
Right. Well, again, thanks so much, Mike, and hope to have you back on here again soon.
All right. Well, I look forward to it. But before then, you'll have Austin back, and I'm looking forward to having him back too.
Yes, we'll have him back on. The plan is for next week.
Sounds good.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here's a note from the Co-op Community Council. Today, Asian Americans of diverse backgrounds make up about 6% of the U.S. population. Though that number may seem small, Asian and Pacific Islander immigrants have played a fundamental part of American history. AAPI individuals helped construct the Transcontinental Railroad, having generated hundreds of billions of dollars for the U.S. economy, and have fought for the U.S. in every major armed conflict since World War I. Despite these contributions, AAPI communities have also been subject to discrimination and violence since they first arrived to this country. Forced internment, discriminatory laws and practices, and violent hate crimes are sadly inextricable from the Asian American experience. Join Co-op and the Community Council throughout the month of May for specially themed programming in honor of these communities. Well, that's all for tonight. Have a great evening, everyone, and stay safe.
Mm-hmm.